Welcome to Radio Chomsky, the alternative news radio station for Auckland. We're introducing a new program today called Earth's Renaissance. Earth's Renaissance is going to be a regular feature on Radio Chomsky, and it's going to be about environmentalism, environmental issues, and related topics such as politics and spirituality. We want to examine the cultural matrix of our modern society, which is trashing the Earth's resources with no thought for the future. We also want to, as well as critiquing our present paradigm of conspicuous consumption and endless consumption, we want to also look at the positive solutions which some people are finding, which have been formulated by some brilliant individuals, such as permaculture, the green movement in general, bio-intensive farming, etc., etc. My name is Jason Sanders, and I'll be your host. And today's episode, the first episode of Earth's Renaissance, is going to be an interview with Kevin Moore. I conducted this interview with Kevin in early November of 2005. Kevin Moore is the author of Burn Baby Burn, and he's a very interesting guy, an energy analyst. An environmentalist. He lives in Pakeringa, Auckland. If you want to give us any kind of feedback, we'd appreciate any feedback. We need to know if we're doing things right, if you have any criticism, or you have any ideas that we could do things better, feel free to send us an email at nonvax@yahoo.co.nz. nonvax@yahoo.co.nz. And now for the first episode. And today on the show, we're going to interview Kevin Moore. Kevin Moore is a New Zealander from Auckland who is the author of the book Burn Baby Burn, a book about the coming age of oil depletion, the terrifying truth about global warming and the global consumer society. Kevin is an energy consultant, no, is an environmental consultant and an independent energy analyst. So Kevin, welcome to the show.
Nice to meet you, Jason, again. Well, what can we talk about this afternoon that's going to interest the viewers? Or I should say listeners, shouldn't I? Sorry for a radio program.
Yeah, well, welcome to Radio Chomsky and Earth's Renaissance. Kevin, I wanted to ask you about your book. Can you elaborate a bit more about it, Burn Baby Burn?
Yes, well, look, this really was a result of many years of working in industry. And it occurred to me that there was a lot of things going on that really shouldn't be going on. A lot of managers who had managerial policies which said certain things should happen, but when it actually came to the pipe breaking and the pollution running down the drive or whatever, they were out there with the hoses quickly trying to wash it away before anybody noticed. So, and just observations. Energy wastage in industry. I was involved. I've been involved in fertilizer industry and tanning industry, and also as a company representative. And I just could see things going on that shouldn't have been going on. I've got a degree in chemistry from UK.
You're an industrial chemist, aren't you?
Yeah. Well, I actually did pure chemistry at university,
right.
and then did a diploma in technology after that. So I'm reasonably well trained in the use of chemicals. I'm a reasonably bright sort of person. I understand physical principles. I was always good at physics and maths at school, and this is just a life's accumulation of technical knowledge, experience, and so I got into my mind to just report my feelings about this and question what was going on. And when I approached New Zealand publishers, nobody was very interested in this at all. So the circumstances turned out that I wrote the book, but it was actually published in Taiwan and under independent sponsorship.
Right. What was the idea behind the book? Why did you feel the book was necessary?
Well, I could see what was happening to the world, that in terms of global warming, the issues were not being addressed. In terms of oil depletion, again, the issue wasn't being addressed. It was perfectly obvious that problems were in the making and getting worse, basically, by the day. And the policies of most governments and city councils and most organisations actually didn't make any sense if we were considering the future of the next generation as our prime consideration. It seems to me that our generation is the first ever that is prepared to sacrifice its own children's lives to consumerism. Now, no generation prior to ours has considered its own selfish interest as greater, the criterion for life.
How is it that consumerism could destroy the planet?
Well, we need to have a little bit of knowledge about the action of CO2 on climate. Now, if we think about carbon dioxide content of the air, it has fluctuated a lot over various geological eras. But in the last few thousand years, it was about 280 parts per million, right through until the Industrial Revolution in Britain in the late 1700s.
So it's pretty constant.
Yeah. There were fluctuations, but fairly constant. I mean, nobody can be absolutely certain, say, it was exactly 280, it might have been 278 or 282,
sure,
but I'm sure. You know, we're talking in terms of concepts rather than exact figures here.
Yeah.
So let's say 280 for the last several thousand years. Well, and that was until about 1780, 1800 or so, and then Britain started putting a lot of carbon dioxide into the air.
Through its
coal
use burning?
Of coal.
Which drove the Industrial Revolution.
Yeah.
The engines, the train engines and all that.
Yeah, as I wrote in an article about 18 months ago, I mean, we could blame Thomas Savery for all of this back in 1698 when he invented a steam pump.
But of course they didn't know about those. They didn't know
exactly
about the
outcomes. Exactly. Now, everything they did was in ignorance. And I think we can say this really right through until perhaps the 80s. Certainly there were theoretical physicists who talked about the effect of carbon dioxide on the atmosphere even 100 years ago. Mm. People said, wow, well, this is an interesting thing. What would happen if we just carried on burning all this coal? You know, maybe this is going to affect the climate. Now, the reality was that nobody was particularly interested and it didn't seem to have very much effect. And it was just a sort of scientific curiosity, really, that,
people in ivory towers were...
In the 60s and 70s, people started saying, oh, just a minute. Oh, look, it's not 280 anymore. Look, it's 300. Oh, it's 320. Oh, this is interesting. Oh, it's 340. Oh, it's 360. But when we start plotting this curve, then we see that it's actually accelerating, the rate of change is increasing. And now we're at the point of the carbon dioxide content of the air is around 380, or as it was 280. And I say, oh, well, what's 100 parts per million carbon dioxide? Well, we only need to look at Katrina or the year 2003 in Europe, where the average temperature was 3.8 degrees higher than the long-term average, to start to appreciate what,
So the thing is, they've taken ice core samples, haven't they, out of the Antarctic, and they can actually prove that in eras where the temperatures on average around the whole globe were a lot higher, there was a lot higher carbon rates, parts per million in the atmosphere as well. So it does correlate. The amount of carbon in the atmosphere correlates very, very well with the temperatures.
Right. Yes. In particular, there's now a plot of carbon dioxide content against deviation of temperature. And that they're not exactly parallel, but they're moving up together.
Right.
And of course, there's a great denial industry now. clutching of straws to say that this is not so. It can't be so because business interests can't have it to be so. Because our entire economy, our whole way of life is dependent on putting carbon dioxide into the air in massive quantities.
That's right. So where does it mainly come from? And from the consumer society? Which parts of the consumer society are producing carbon dioxide as a byproduct?
All of it.
Cars are obvious,
The entire consumer society.
Which areas? I mean, cars are an obvious example.
Well, okay, we start with building a house. Concrete. Now, to make concrete, you have to have cement. To make cement, you start off with limestone. Now, so to make limestone into cement, you've got to drive the carbon dioxide out of the rock. So the cement industry is a massive source of carbon dioxide.
I didn't know that.
Now, how do you heat this rock? Usually by a gas furnace. So burning the natural gas is producing carbon dioxide. So there's an inherent, immediately before you do anything else, here's this bag of cement, where you've put a massive amount of carbon dioxide into the air, just creating this bag of cement, which you then transport from the cement works to the place where it's used. Carbon dioxide.
What percentage of the, say, out of 100, what percentage would be from the cement industry, for example? It's a rough, very, very rough approximation.
I couldn't actually give you a figure on that, Jason, because look, it depends where you are. I mean, some countries it's higher than others.
Sure.
It depends how the cement's made. I mean, if you were to go back to 17th century Britain, the lime works were operated by chopping down trees, burning carbon there. Well, there was actually, in a sense, not too much net increase in carbon dioxide because they were taking a renewable resource. So the carbon that was in the trees, put into the atmosphere, well, it was reabsorbed again to grow more trees. But the problem is now we're extracting carbon from the ground and putting it into the air. And that's in the form of coal or oil or gas. So just completing that previous discussion, and then we can investigate these other aspects. So the cement, it has put carbon dioxide into the air. The transport of the cement to the place it's used has put carbon dioxide into the air. Steel, now you've got steel reinforcing. Well, production of steel is an extremely dirty activity, and it adds massive amounts of carbon dioxide to the air because you're using, originally back in you know, Roman, British times, steel, well, iron was a pretty rare metal. But then we, Bessemer, you know, we can start mass producing this stuff. How? By using coal, coke.
That's right.
Carbon, straight into the air.
They have massive furnaces, so, don't they? They have massive furnaces and steel.
Right, yeah, so massive steel is where
I can see Glenbrook in the distance.
Right.
Just, so, you know, belching out smoke.
Belching out smoke, but belching out invisible pollutants. Carbon dioxide is an invisible. Now, I mean, this is where I get really angry. I mean, I had a conversation with Christofratis, who is supposedly environmental lecturer at Auckland University. And he says to me, carbon dioxide is a harmless gas. I mean, where is this guy coming from? We've got people around the world saying this is the greatest threat to human existence, and we've got people at Auckland University saying it's a harmless gas. So
but he would be, correct me if I'm wrong, but he would be a pretty lone figure
amongst
the scientific establishment nowadays.
Oh, that's true, but you see, who will the New Zealand Herald or National Radio go to if they want to interview somebody about carbon dioxide? Oh, they'll drag out these people who say it's not a problem. They won't talk to people like me because I say, hey, this is a huge problem. We're heading in completely the wrong direction and we've got to stop. Well, we can't say that.
Kevin, let's, for the benefit of our viewers, or our listeners, I should say, who don't know an awful lot about climate change, it's pretty much the consensus of most experts in weather systems and geophysicists around the world, isn't it? That climate change is a reality and it's man caused by human beings' activity.
Absolutely, yes. No question. Well, there is a question about it, but the only people that question it are people who have a vested interest in saying it's not so. So these people will be basically funded by somebody like Exxon Mobil or whatever, other oil companies, steel manufacturers, concrete manufacturers, whatever. People who have a vested interest in suppression of the truth because their business is dependent on people not knowing the truth. I mean, if every New Zealander knew that a bag of cement has resulted in global warming, the production of the steel has resulted in aluminium. I mean, everything, every material basically, except the timber.
Of course, plastic.
Am I right? Has generated some global warming. Now, if you take the timber, carting the timber from wherever it was grown to the point of use, that's global warming. Every nail, it's global warming.
Sure.
Everything, clay, tiles, anything, that any material, basically.
We've got some pretty big names in the scientific world starting to speak out about this. I mean, Sir David King, who's the chief scientific advisor to Tony Blair's Labour government.
Absolutely.
He came out last January, I think it was, and he said that he did some pretty radical things, didn't
he? Bigger threats of the planet than terrorism. Forget about terrorism.
Yeah.
That's not a threat. Global warming. In fact, he said that Antarctica will literally be the only inhabitable landmass unless we get global warming.
By the end of the 21st century?
Well, it's hard to pinpoint.
On present trends.
Yes.
Based on
present trends. Because, you see, look, when you've got something which is accelerating at an unknown rate, and it could be self-reinforcing, how do you put a time frame on it? You can't. Okay? But let's say, look, going back to our discussion about carbon dioxide, well, it was rising at half a part per million per year. Then it was rising at one part per million per year. Then it was 1.5 parts per million, per million per year. Now we're increasing at between 2 and 3 parts per million per year. Now this is where it gets very interesting, because the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, now they've just come up with this arbitrary figure of 400 as the threshold beyond which we get to the point of no return.
I see, I didn't know they'd actually come up with a figure.
Oh, that's it. Yes!
This is the United Nations. Again, what was it? The
United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change.
Right.
Okay. Now, I mean, this is thousands of scientists around the world. Okay. They're working on this problem and they can see what's happening. And it's an arbitrary figure. I mean, you can't know. In fact, I mean, there is some evidence we've already gone past it. Maybe the threshold for abrupt climate change was actually 370. And we're now at 380.
Nobody knows for sure.
We don't know. But looking at what's happening around the world, we've actually now got a runaway situation self-reinforcing, insofar as the tundra of Siberia contains trapped carbon dioxide and trapped methane. Now, trapped carbon dioxide is bad enough, but trapped methane is 20 times worse.
Why?
Why is
methane gas, which I believe comes out of animals'
farts
basically, of cattle and, and sheep, and of course human beings.
Yes.
But it also comes out of swamps, frozen swamps like the tundra.
And leaks from the oil industry. Look,
don't forget,
in the past, it was the oil they wanted. Now, there's always gas associated with it. Well, this methane came up, it's just leaked into the atmosphere.
Sure.
Or it may have been burnt off.
Why is methane? Because I believe it's 4 times more potent.
No, 20.
20 times more potent.
Yes.
Causing global warming than carbon dioxide.
Yes.
Why is methane? How does methane do that?
Well, it's just simple. It's a chemical or a physical aspect, physical chemistry. It's the absorption of energy and re-radiation of energy. Basically, any of these gases act like a blanket. So it's like, it's basically like putting more blankets on your bed.
Right.
You're trapping the heat. So, the fortunate thing is that the concentration of methane is relatively low compared to the carbon dioxide. And one good thing about methane is that if methane passes through a flame, it will be converted into carbon dioxide. But the scary thing here is that there are deposits of methane ice, these clathrates, on continental shelves. And if they are disturbed, you can actually get methane erupting up to the surface. There, I mean, there's the potential for a doubling of the methane concentration in the atmosphere.
In a very short time?
Well, very rapidly. Now, I mean, we talked about past geological ages, and this is where it gets very interesting, because there have been abrupt climate change events in the past. And one of these has been attributed to the eruption of a volcanic system under an oil field. Now, the effect of this was basically to vaporize all this organic matter and rapidly increase the carbon dioxide content of the atmosphere. People are talking in terms of a rise in temperature of 5 to 8 degrees Celsius, the average temperature of the planet, over a period of a decade or so.
This cataclysmic event caused it.
This is abrupt climate change.
Yeah.
So for a long, long time, there was basically an abrupt termination to life on the planet, which was, for a long, long time, unaccountable for. Nobody could say, well, why had this event happened?
When was this event supposed to happen?
I think it was 55 million years ago from memory. Don't quote me on that.
Sure.
But I think it was 55 million years ago. I mean, we had the collision with the asteroid.
Which destroyed all large dinosaurs.
Item, which was the dinosaur, 65
die off,
million
die
years.
Die off of the dinosaurs.
Right, yes,
yeah.
Okay. So there's certainly a very plausible theory which links the Earth's average temperature with the concentration of carbon dioxide and methane in the atmosphere. So the interesting thing is somehow the Earth has at various times recovered from these cataclysmic events, but over what period of time? I mean,
millions and millions of years, quite possibly.
Certainly thousands of years.
I don't think
tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands, and, you know, yeah.
So we're not going to be around to basically, find out how long it'll be.
So we are actually playing with fire here, that we could trigger an abrupt climate change event, and the temperature of the planet could shoot up by 5 or 8 degrees over a period of a decade or so. And that's the end of life on the planet. And this is what David King was basically alerting us to when he said Antarctica could be the only inhabitable landmass by the end of this. He's saying, if we trigger abrupt climate change, that's it. Party over, guys. End of humanity. Or the greater portion of it. Okay, maybe you're going to get 2 or 3% of the population that can go and move to Antarctica, but what about the other 6.2 billion, whatever it's going to be?
Sure. So this is scary stuff, Kevin.
Oh, absolutely.
This is really, really frightening.
Well, this is why I said the terrifying truth. This is why, in my book, but you see, I mean, it's the response of the system to this sort of information. No, it can't happen. Oh, no, this is unproven. So you've got then, you know, this whole business of the of people in power who refuse to look at the evidence or discount the evidence. And it doesn't matter what the evidence is. We've got people like Trevor Mallard, for instance, who was, you know, Minister of Energy. According to the IEA, peak oil won't be until 2067. You know, well, it turns out, of course, that that figure was based on totally flawed analysis. But it's very convenient for somebody in this official position to deliberately use a figure which is based on fraud analysis.
Okay, Kevin, right. Well, that's to do with peak oil. I mean, we're talking about climate change.
Well, now we've got the same problem, you see.
Yeah.
So we've got people who say, oh, well, look, this is unproven. Oh, well, look, the temperature of the planet, that's just a natural cycle. Oh, it's sunspot activity. Oh, it's the Earth wobble.
What happened?
Anything rather than face the reality.
Kevin, right? Just to stop you there for a moment. What has been the official response from leaders in the Labour government, the Labour Progressive government? What has been the official response to climate change? They are acknowledging that it's going to happen to some extent, aren't they? Because they wanted to sign the Kyoto.
New Zealand has signed and ratified Kyoto. Yep. Yes.
So there is some acknowledgement.
So it says, well, we're going to reduce our carbon emissions, but we'll make it a 5% reduction over the next four, five, 10 years. Maybe by 2012 we might get a... Right? So that's what they say. And then what happens? Well, we'll have policies that say we'll have more motorways, we'll have more transport, we'll have more tourism, and we'll have more trade. This is just total nonsense. How the hell can you have a reduction in your carbon emissions? This government of Helen Clark says, oh, well, we've got a bit of an energy crisis coming along. We acknowledge that we're running out of gas, so we better build a coal-fired power station. Now, burning coal, going back to what I was saying previously, is one of the fastest ways to put carbon into the atmosphere.
You know what they're saying. They're saying it will be more clean burning.
Yeah, well, okay. Yeah, look, I went to an energy forum around a year ago. And there are all these people who say, yes, but clean burning coal. I said, well, excuse me, before we go any further, can somebody explain to me what clean burning coal is? Because as far as I'm concerned, it's an oxymoron. There cannot be any such thing as clean burning coal if you're going to say that carbon dioxide and global warming is the biggest threat to humanity. How can burning coal possibly be clean? Ah, yes. Well, you see, this is all very interesting. Now, I went to a lecture again about this whole thing. It was actually Jim Salinger at the Auckland University.
Oh, he's from the
So he gets up and he says, yeah, look, here's the hockey stick here. Here's the rapid rise in temperature since 1998. Yeah, this is correlating with increased carbon dioxide. So then I went to another presentation about... Well, how are we going to keep the lights running? You know, are we going to build Cumbia? So this was a representative of Colcorp, Solid Energy. Okay, well, I won't name the person, but... well, look, here are the figures. This is the clean current burning coal. Here's the mercury emitted by non-clean burning coal station, right? And here's the mercury that's emitted by a clean burning coal. So... Well, look, we've knocked back the mercury by about 30%, or 40%, I forget the exact figure now, but 32 or something. So, you know, instead of emitting 100 kilograms of mercury, this clean burning one only emits 64. There you are. I mean, this is the kind of...
Would you really want to still live downwind from the coal?
Exactly.
A coal-fired power station?
So, clean burning coal is actually an oxymoron. It was generated in by the American coal industry. It's just another way of bypassing reality.
Kevin, so what you're saying...
There is no such thing as clean burning
coal. Kevin, can I just clarify? So what you seem to be saying, what you're implying... With that mercury analogy, is that the same with the CO2?
Well, no, with CO2, we say, well, we don't count CO2 as a pollutant. That's a harmless gas, as per Chris de Freitas. So if anybody says, what about the carbon dioxide? I say, the Auckland University professor Chris de Freitas said this is a harmless gas. You don't need to worry about that.
So when they talk about clean burning coal stations, they're actually just not even counting the CO2 emissions.
Not even counting the CO2. No, no.
Which is the most important emission.
Well, it depends.
Overall importance, that is the most important.
If you are burning coal, which has got a high mercury content, and you're living like 10 kilometres from this thing, then the mercury
downwind.
Is going to be...
Downwind.
Right. But if you're talking about the overall...
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about.
The planetary problem of global warming, then obviously it's the CO2 that's the...
Well, that's what I mean. In terms of climate change, which is going to possibly kill us, it makes it the most important.
Which is going to induce... If we're going to raise the CO2 point to the point that we induce abrupt climate change, and this is happening already in Alaska, they're experiencing abrupt climate change now. It's happening.
What is happening in Alaska?
Well, again, don't quote me on the exact figures, but I've been reading about a meltdown of Alaska insofar as pipelines or, you know, the supports are melting because of all permafrost.
Permafrost is,
right,
is melting.
Buildings falling down, great rifts, massive erosion on the coastline. Various species are dying because their habitat is being disappeared. And average temperatures, like 6 degrees above... What has been the long-term average? Now, when we talk about long-term average, a lot of them were worked over the period, say, 1961 to 90, whatever, 30-year period. That's the kind of thing that the Australian Bureau of Meteorology does. They say, well, look, here's our long-term average. What's our deviation, you know? what's the, you know, how far are we from that? And it's scary. Very scary.
It is scary. That sounds pretty bad in Alaska, Kevin. Of course, there's been a lot of news recently, though it's not very constant, of course, because they don't want it to sort of keep people to get too worried, about the situation in Greenland and the Arctic. Can you elaborate a bit about that? You know more than I do.
Yes, well, you've got to appreciate that there are two kinds of ice. There's the ice that's in the water and there's the ice that's on the land. Now, ice that's in water, if it melts, will not affect the actual depth of the oceans. So the real worry in terms of sea level rise is ice that's on land masses. And of course the bad news is that the ice in Greenland is melting at an unprecedented rate. So we've got these glaciers, we've got, you know, nobody knows the exact quantities because it's very difficult to determine, but we know that the ice is pouring off of Greenland in the form of basically cold water. The whole thing is heating up. It becomes self-reinforcing because once you've lost that ice cover, the land then absorbs more heat.
So that's right, because ice is white and it reflects sunlight, whereas land is darker and it absorbs heat. Ocean is darker and it absorbs heat as well.
So we've now got another self-reinforcing pattern.
Feedback mechanism.
Positive feedback system here operating. So it is calculated that if that all of the ice in Greenland melts, then it's going to raise the Earth's sea level by several metres. One figure is 7 metre rise in sea level. Now that basically annihilates Holland, London, Shanghai, half of New York. Well, New Orleans is a goner anyway, but dozens of major cities around the world. So
including possibly parts of New Zealand like Napier.
Napier will be a goner. Christchurch, a 7 metre rise. Look, even a 2 metre rise will devastate Napier. And a lot of Christchurch. This is quite fascinating. I actually went to Sydney 3 or 4 years ago, and the Botanic Gardens, just round by the Opera House.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, at high tide, the water laps through some little portholes. A rise in sea level of around 40 or 50 centimetres will flood that region of Sydney. Now, you look at Britain, the Fenlands, they're actually losing land now to the sea. They're abandoning farmland already because it's not worth the cost and the energy of trying to, you know, to save it. And then you get this ridiculous scheme to save Venice by spending good knows how many billions of, you know, well, euros, I suppose we should say, you know, since it's Italy, on some kind of buoy system that's going to come up from the from the sea. So if there's a high tide, it's going to hold back the waters, and you know. And if it's a low tide, they're going to drop these things. It's fascinating. And of course, you see anything that we do. The classic example here, Jason, is that you've got a forest fire burning. So you have helicopters then ferrying water to put out the forest fire. But these helicopters are then burning up massive amounts of oil, which is a rapidly depleting resource, and producing massive amounts of carbon dioxide. So any solution to any of these problems exacerbates the problem. It's a no-win situation. And we've got a society that's in total denial of these realities because they're actually too difficult to face. And this is why, there's two aspects here. You've got the economists who, A, don't know, don't want to know, won't look at the figures. If you put them under their noses, they say, no, these are not true.
Who do? Economists.
Right?
And economists don't understand anything about geology.
Right? Now, yes. And I there's probably, perhaps it's an appropriate time to say. You know, geochemistry beats ideology every time. It's the same with, you know, the oil
That's right. Geochemistry beats free market ideology every single time.
Absolutely. Geology beats economics every time. If you're talking about oil supply, and I know this is another aspect, but they're linked. Because our whole world economy basically has been set up to use energy and ignore the fact that there are pollutants coming from the use of energy. So we say, yeah, look, we're quite happy to buy an SUV or a racing car. That generates the sales and that keeps the money flowing. Don't worry about the fact that peak oil probably has already arrived.
Before we get on to peak oil.
Well, let me just finish this sentence. Don't worry about that. Don't worry about that this vehicle is going to be producing tons of carbon dioxide. The whole system is geared to this. Denial that you're using up finite resources and denial that you're producing exhaust gases. I mean, it's not only that. Of course, it's the nitrogen oxides. I mean, it's the whole system. It's tourism. Planes. Sure. Everywhere you look, anything that people do that's not a natural process is adding carbon to the system and taking us that little bit closer to abrupt climate change.
Now, I want to cover peak oil with you because you're obviously a bit of an expert on that. But before we do, I want to go back to this Greenland ice shelf. I mean, the Greenland ice shelf, I believe, is 3 miles thick in parts, or was it two miles thick?
We shouldn't really use the word ice shelf. You see, now, let's just use that word correctly because...
Ice shelf on top of the land, isn't it?
Yeah,
ice shelf
a couple of years ago, the Larsen B ice shelf in Antarctica collapsed. This is ice just sitting in this bay, basically.
It's floating on water, more or less.
Gone, right?
Okay. But what would you call it then in Greenland? What would you call it? I'd call it an ice shelf on top of the land.
Well, okay, all right. We'll use that. Okay.
It's about 2 or 3 miles thick, isn't it? So we're talking many, many tons. Hundreds, thousands of tons. Millions of tons.
Talking about millions of tons.
Millions of tons.
Yes.
Tons or tons. Tons of ice.
Ice.
And, of course, it's going to affect... This is what I hear. Scientists are speculating very, very realistically it could affect the North Atlantic conveyor belt, which keeps Europe artificially warm, six degrees warmer than it should be for its latitude.
Exactly.
That's quite on the cards, isn't it? All that
fresh
cold water.
Fresh water pouring into that region between North America and Greenland. I mean, it's not only that, it's also why this is the ice melting, but it's particularly this fresh water. Yeah. It's disturbing the thermohaline cycle.
So we're only a few years away.
Well, we don't
potentially
know.
Potentially, we could only be, who knows, how many years away from Europe being plunged into a mini ice age.
We just do not know. And this is the whole point. This is where it comes to the precautionary principle. Because if you don't know it's safe, you shouldn't do it. But what we are doing as humanity, basically, is saying, well, we'll just keep ploughing ahead and hope for the best. Well, that's a recipe for disaster because that's exactly what the Easter Islanders did. They said, we need to build statues. Never mind that, we're going to chop down the last tree in the process. Whoops, oh dear, our population's just gone from 10,000 to 300 or what. I don't know the exact figure, but, population collapse because they chopped down the last tree. They couldn't even build a canoe in the end. The Mayans did it. Chopped down all the trees, built their canals and blah, blah, blah. They devoted all their energy to building these various temples and pyramids and whatever, and you're gone.
And of course, the Arctic, the North Pole, which is just above Greenland, probably has even more ice in it. And now that seems satellite photographs reveal...
Yeah, that doesn't actually matter. That's not going to cause sea level rise, but what we are going to have is climate change. Because
the ice in the North Pole is floating, so a lot of it's underwater.
Well, so
it's not going to cause sea level rise.
There's no sea level rise associated with the melting of ice.
There would have to be some though, because some of it is above.
No, because the reason it floats is because it's less dense than water.
Right, so it'll shrink.
Its volume will decrease as it melts.
Right.
You end up with the same quantity of
water. I get what you mean. Right? I get what you mean.
So don't worry about the sea level, right? That's associated with the melting of ice on
above,
land masses.
Like Antarctica.
And Antarctica or glaciers around, in Peru or the Andes or whatever. So that ice melting is adding to the net quantity of water in the oceans.
Sure.
So we get. I mean, there's other is. Now, there's the other aspect you see is actual climate change, because when you warm water up, it expands. Okay. So you put some cold water in a mug, stick it in the microwave, it'll go up a little bit. No, it's not huge, but when you look at the depth of the oceans, it doesn't have to go up very much to flood cities.
Flood low-lying areas.
Areas. Beaches. So this is where we're heading. But what's really worrying, Jason, is this climate change thing again, because it becomes self-reinforcing. The melting of the ice raises the temperature, which then allows more carbon dioxide to come out of the peat bogs in Ireland or tundra in northern Canada, which then increases the effect of these gases. So it raises the temperature a bit more, which means that you then get faster heating. And there's always the balance between that and the radiation out into space. But quite clearly, the blanket effect is beating this radiation effect. Now, the real scary one, and not many people know about this, is global dimming. Global dimming is the production of pollutants by the burning of fossil fuels, and these are distributed through the atmosphere. And nobody really knows too much about this, but after the 9/11 attacks, the air over America was very, very clear. And this is only hearsay. The temperature went up for 3 days, very spectacular, very suddenly, because more heat was able to reach the ground.
Because all airplanes were grounded.
Yes.
They weren't producing pollution.
They were
and the pollution had been protecting, had
yes.
been stopping certain amounts of sun energy
yes.
going through to the biosphere.
Yeah. So there is the real possibility that when peak oil hits, this is actually going to make climate change worse. Now, the other aspect of peak oil, of course, is that what are people going to use instead of oil? Well, are they going to start using coal? I mean, we've got the government here saying, oh, we've got a bit of a problem with gas. Shall we import gas from Australia? Oh, that's a bit hard. Well, in the meantime, we'll just use a bit of coal. We'll just forget about Kyoto for the moment and... because Kyoto has just become an exercise of economists of trading carbon emissions, and it's not actually anything to do with dealing with the problem. So,
I want to go back to the Arctic, because that's really... A lot of people aren't hearing about this in the mainstream news. They're not hearing about it, certainly not hearing it on our TV news. But that is big time, isn't it? What has happened
okay,
in the Arctic?
Sorry to interrupt you. Let's just think about the Greenland thing, right? Now, this report came out... I've forgotten exactly when it was now, but melting at a rate of 1 meter per month, this ice in Greenland. So does TVNZ say, hey guys, this is the big story of the day, everybody needs to know about this, this is the future of the planet? No, this is hidden away as a 3 minute sort of topical interest item at the end of the weather, right? And so no wonder nobody knows about this stuff, because the media don't want you to know. So they're pandering, of course, to commercial interests. But I mean, it's TVNZ's prime business is to make money. It's got to serve its advertisers. It's got to serve the government. Well, the government's in denial anyway. So if you make a complaint, they're not interested. I've done this. I've written to TVNZ and they, that's an interesting letter. Well, of course, this is just your opinion. We will see. You know, this is the sort of nonsense that you get from these organisations.
Okay, I want to go back to...
It's institutionalised denial, so this is why nobody knows about it, because it's part of the system
of course,
that you shouldn't know.
Yeah.
Because if you knew, then you're going to start changing your habits, and the whole system then collapses once people start changing their habits.
Okay, Kevin, now, with the Arctic, there are satellite photographs... Now, aren't there, showing that it has decreased, the amount of ice in the Arctic has decreased about 20% since the 1970s.
Yes, that's
right. It's around about 20%. It's rapidly decreasing year by year. And basically, boats can go through the Northwest Passage, which could never they could never have done this 20 or 30 years ago.
That's right, yes.
And you've got people who, scientists are predicting that within a few years, people are going to be able to take a boat to the magnetic point of the North Pole, the
yes.
centre of the North Pole,
yes.
which was, you know, previously just impossible because you had to go overland with dogs and sleighs.
Yes.
Now this is pretty big news, really, and we're not. Have you seen it on the news?
No, because you see, basically, Jason, I don't bother to watch television news because it's nonsense. It's just trivia interspersed with adverts. So if you want to know what's happening, you've got to use the internet. Now, you use the internet, and there are heaps of really good sites out there, and you'll see the pictures. Oh, you know, I mean, Earth Observatory is a very good one. This is NASA pictures. You know, these satellites are going around there, circling the Earth continuously, and they're taking snapshots. So you see the picture and the analysis. Oh, hang on, this is interesting. And again, don't quote me on the exact figures, but it's something like, 2003, 6% melt. 2004, 7% melt. 2005, 8% melt. And what was really interesting on the graph was this year, whereas in mid-September, normally the melt has ceased and it starts reforming the ice, it was still melting at the end of September. Again, unprecedented. So, it gets scary. And as you say, 20% loss in sea ice, particularly since about 1998. 1998 was the big year for climate change. And they said, hang on, you know, what's going on here? And then 99 wasn't, you know, it sort of dropped back again. But then 2003... In Europe, 30,000 people died from high temperatures. America now, we've got this whole business of the heating of the Caribbean and that Gulf of Mexico. Now, they're talking temperatures there of the water of 28, 30, possibly even 31 degrees. And when you've got
degrees Celsius.
Celsius.
Which is very, very high for water.
Yeah. I mean, no wonder that this is a massive amount of heat energy. This water is then evaporating, forming these massive storm systems. And until very, very recently, Bush was saying, oh, well, no, climate change is not actually happening. You know, global warming is just a beat up by environmentalists to sabotage the American economy. We can't afford to deal with climate change. No, what's important is, you know...
Well, he would say that, wouldn't he? I mean, he represents the oil industry.
Exactly. So it always comes back to the oil industry.
Yeah.
Everything.
Sure.
And now you look at logging, and this is where it all ties in so far as what are they using to chop down these trees? Petrol-powered train saws, right? So peak oil can't come fast enough as far as I'm concerned.
Okay, now let's get on.
So if these guys can't afford to buy petrol to run their chainsaw, then we're not going to chop down these trees quite so quickly.
Okay, now let's get on to peak oil, because, you know, you're a bit of an expert on that. What would our listeners need to know about peak oil? Tell us all in a nutshell about peak oil.
Well, okay, Kevin. In a nutshell.
By the way, everyone, I'm speaking to Kevin Moore, who's an environmental consultant and an independent energy analyst.
Peak oil, Jason.
Peak oil.
When I was at university, way back in the 70s, there was discussion about the fact that resources were finite. We don't have infinite resources of anything. There's, you know, there's a,
of course,
there's
the
a
Earth,
certain quantity.
The Earth
know,
is finite.
Earth, right, you know, a certain amount of oxygen, a certain amount of silicon,
yeah.
Right? And there's a certain amount of oil. Nobody knows exactly how much. But this planet has been gone over for the last... really about 80 years, pretty thoroughly. I mean, it was back in 1859 that Drake actually drilled his first well in Pennsylvania and, you know, struck oil. And, hey, well, you know, we've got a gusher. Now, a guy called Hubbert in 56, who was an oil geologist with much experience, predicted that the American... production or extraction is a better word of oil would peak around 1970. He said, you know, there's the field. We've worked out where the oil is. We've worked out what we're extracting, blah, blah, blah. You know, peak. Well, people just laughed at it and said, oh, don't be silly. You know, this can't happen. People have been predicting a peak for years. A peak meaning the point of maximum extraction. Well, okay. Well, it happened. 72, people looked and said, oh, yeah, well, our production has peaked. or extraction of oil has peaked.
That meaning that they are no longer getting quite as much oil as their peak year.
I can't remember.
It's depleting.
Exact figure, but something like 12 or 14 million barrels a day.
That was the peak.
Right, and now they're producing about 9 or so, and it's dropping about 400,000 barrels a day per year.
So basically, from 1970 onwards, the USA had to become a net importer of oil for the first time in its history.
Going back in 1920s, they had so much oil, they didn't know what the hell to do with it. So, we've got to get people out of their trams. We've got to get these people into cars. We've got to build a road system. And end of suburbia is a very good resource for for an analysis of that. It just shows how big oil and car companies work together to sabotage the rail system and the tramway system.
And public transport.
Yeah, they bought them up and ripped them out and said, here, buy a car instead and use this oil. We've got too much of it.
They created freeways.
Oil was cheaper than water in Texas in the 1920s. Now, but of course, you see, used up. So then America starts importing oil.
Now, Hubbard, just to go back, sorry to interrupt, but Hubbard based his analysis, his predictions, on the discovery of major oil fields, didn't he?
And
he
said there's a four-decade
lag between the last major oil fields that got discovered and the peak. And I believe that the 1960s, because that was the last decade where they discovered the most major world oil fields.
Well, let's not
so there'd be a four-decade lag between that and world oil extraction.
What you're saying is true, but let's not confuse this. You have a field, right, and you start drilling, and the first oil flows quite quickly into your well. And then after a while, you have to start pumping. Right, so what they tend to do, we'll drill another well here, you keep drilling. Well, when you get to this peak point, it doesn't matter how much drilling you do and how hard you pump, the extraction rate goes down. Right, so America experienced that in the 70s. So then, of course, they developed Alaska. Same thing's happened. Peaked. And all companies have explored pretty well everywhere that's easily explorable. And you're quite right.
So you're saying it's a combination of those two things? The discovery of major oil fields and the fact that they get into the bottom half of their,
well,
of their
the easy oil comes out first.
Yes, it squirts out.
And then it gushes out. You get a massive, and this is something that's very important, the energy profit ratio, or energy input compared to the energy output. Yeah. So you spend a little bit of energy and you get all this energy back again. Right? You've got a great energy profit ratio there. Well, so what's happened? Well, look, Britain. British economy was going down the gurgler in the 60s and 70s, and then they discovered North Sea oil and gas. And during the 80s, things were still, not too good, and then through the 90s, everything's wonderful. Oh, guys, we've got a real strong economy. Yeah, lovely. Don't worry about it. Well, now, of course, you said they peaked. Britain peaked around...
When did Britain peak?
Around 2002. And it's always a little bit difficult to pinpoint, because what happens, you get one particular well or one particular field peaks, and then there's another well, and there may be some discovery of another field just a little bit further out. But it's now acknowledged that the North Sea has peaked and is on its way down, which means that Britain now, every month, has to import more oil.
And gas.
And gas. They're talking now about a crisis this winter. It all ties in, again, with the climate change aspect. Because the last time they had a severe winter was actually about 1963. That was a real nasty one for Britain. With snow on the ground in the south of England for 3 months. Now, I know a lot about many things, but I can't tell you exactly why. Meteorologists are now predicting an unusual change in the North Atlantic Oscillation, which is an air system. And they're saying there's a 67% chance of cold air being dragged down from the north and covering Britain and much of Northern Europe. They're saying there's a 67% chance of a winter similar to 63, which will push up gas consumption and oil consumption. I know people trying to keep warm. Mm-hmm. Oh dear. because they actually haven't got enough gas supply. So you've got Tony Blair and the energy and industry in Britain frantic now, praying for a warm winter, basically saying, "Oh yeah, climate change, oh this is great, you know." Let's pray that we have an early spring, that, you know.
Yeah.
Again, you know, just going back to this whole thing about denial of reality, because in Britain, they're now finding that plants, spring flowers are blossoming 2 weeks earlier. I mean, all these events, birds are nesting, and the whole natural world is responding to this. So,
getting back to peak oil.
So what
we're talking about Hubbard and his predictions. Now, he made the prediction for America. It turned out to be true.
Yes.
All of a sudden, a lot of the other oil experts said, wow, he was right. Then they looked more closely at his peak oil production for the world.
Now, he said...
Now, when was this going to be?
He said around the year 2000. Now, remember, we were talking back in 60.
Late 50s, yeah.
Right? He said 2000. Well, it didn't happen because... Well, two things, really. Here you've got the OPEC raising the prices and that depressed use of oil. So we've actually got a little hump on the side of this.
Back in the late 70s, early 80s, there was a slight decrease in the acceleration of use of oil.
Production actually declined, or use declined.
Right.
Because the OPEC countries turned off the taps. They said, well, okay, we want more money for the oil. If you're not going to pay, we'll turn the taps off. And then, you know, this is all associated with the Middle East and the war, you know, between the Arab states and Israel.
We know it's a historical fact.
And the Iran-Contra, and all this business around 1979.
Well, that delayed the peak.
Okay. Now, the big unknown, of course, was the fact that China and India were going to start industrializing. And again, nobody knows exactly how much oil there is. Most oil geologists would say, well, look, this planet's been pretty well explored, probably around 98%, not 100%. And there are still some small finds. But coming back to what you said, the peak of discovery oil was in the 60s. And there's been nothing of significance discovered in the last couple of years.
You're talking about gigantic
big fields.
Oil fields. Like the North Sea oil fields?
That was a moderately big one.
They went huge.
Look, discovered in the 70s and now past peak. So it depends how quickly you extract. Now, Russia, for instance, has been producing oil for a long, long time, and they had a peak, and then because of the collapse of the Russian economy and infrastructure and all the politics, they actually declined. Now, they could have a second peak.
Is that right?
Yes.
When did they peak the first time?
Oh, no, I can't remember the exact year, but it was associated with the collapse.
It was probably in the 90s.
Around 90.
Yeah, around 90. Around about
that. I mean, interesting is the fact that North Korea, was totally dependent on this Russian oil for its economy. Its agricultural system collapsed. They couldn't run the coal mines because you need oil to get coal out of the ground.
Something that Helen Clark and her cronies need to start thinking about, don't
they?
Oh,
no, they don't think about anything except GDP growth, more tourism. I mean, it's just nonsense. I mean, these people are just idiots. There's no other word for it.
Okay.
Back to North Korea, you see, because this is a classic example of what happens when you haven't got oil. Now, look, nobody knows exactly. We're talking about 2 or 3 million people starving to death. We're talking about people in professional jobs, if they have such a thing in North Korea, being told to go and work in the countryside at the weekends in food production. Our entire agricultural system is dependent on oil. Milk. How do we get milk? Where's the young man? You ask a six-year-old kid, how do you get milk? They say, oh, it's a bottle from the supermarket. And where do you get, you know, vegetables? Oh, they come from the supermarket. And you know, everything comes from the supermarket because we've got a society that's largely disconnected from the realities of food production. And the reality of food production is that depending on where you live, particularly in the Western world, like 98% dependent on oil. For the tractors that use oil to plow the land, the herbicides, the pesticides, the urea, for instance, which is made from natural gas, which is another form of oil, if you like, a depleting resource.
The superphosphate you were telling me about?
Well, the superphosphate is, of course, not oil itself, but how do you get the superphosphate? We've got to use a machine to transport it to New Zealand. You know, the whole system will collapse. There is no question about it. The only question is timing. Now, coming back to the oil geologists, they say, well, look, okay, America's peaked. Norway's about peaked. UK's peaked. Nigeria, whoops, Australia. Oh, Indonesia's just peaked. Here's a country that used to export oil, and now their economy's going down the drain because they can't buy oil. Venezuela's peaked. Well, who hasn't? Ah, well, Iraq and Saudi Arabia, maybe one or two of these other Caspian states, you know, Uzbekistan or Turkmenistan, and, you know.
Because the politicians and the oil people, I think, it looks like they believe that round about the Caspian Sea is where the last big oil fields apart from Saudi Arabia.
This is really interesting because, you see, the Americans had this great idea in the 90s that this is where all the oil was, but it hasn't delivered. Now, they're saying, again, that the actual quantity is possibly only around 10 or 20% of these high values that people were speculating around in the 90s. So there's not really that much oil there at all. And, of course, the other thing is the political instability. I mean, these pipelines, they're so incredibly vulnerable. I've forgotten who, I think it was Colin Campbell said, look, all it takes is a guy with a camel, 2 kilograms of Semtex, that's the end of your oil pipeline
for a few days.
Yeah, so this latest one that runs across towards Turkey, they say that, you know, there's 200 or 300 Georgian army troops guarding this against attack. Constant. This is a constant battle, you know.
Sure.
Just to keep the oil flowing.
It's a dirty game, isn't it? This is the whole reason why they went into Afghanistan. The Americans went into Afghanistan. It was because they wanted a Halliburton, which Dick Cheney is a former head of.
Yes.
They wanted to put a big pipeline from Uzbekistan down to the only... They had three choices of ports, apparently. And the best choice... Well, one was through Iran. They couldn't go through there.
Yes.
And the best choice was through Afghanistan.
And through Pakistan, you see. So Pakistan, that was all the bad boy, you know. What, 6-7 years ago, and this, you know, military dictatorship. Oh, suddenly, oh, we're great mates now, yes. Well, yeah. Until there's an earthquake, and then, you know, there's 70 or 80,000 people lying around, and sorry, we haven't got any spare helicopters. I am a bit cynical, but, you know.
So, Kevin, tell me, have we reached peak oil?
The answer, we do not know, but most oil geologists who know what they're talking about say before 2008, Matt Simmons, who's head of the Simmons International Investment Company, has done his own audit of Saudi Arabia, and he says, well, as far as I can see, these guys are not capable of producing much more than they're producing right now. So you can discount any promise made by any Arab oil minister about raising production from, you know, their current levels up to 15 or 25 million barrels a day. It is just not going to happen. In fact, the big field, this Galwar field, is 40 years old. They're forcing seawater into this field to get the oil out, and they've got these separator systems.
Right.
And what the oil geologists say, well, one of the great danger is that you can actually wreck the production from the field by overpumping, because once this seawater, or it could be fresh water, but anyway, starts channeling and gets past the oil, you start pumping more water than oil.
Right. Because oil floats on water, doesn't it? So they've got the oil on top of the water.
Yeah.
So that's how they're pumping it out.
Yeah, so there are infrastructure issues here. There's the insurgency against the House of Saud, which, you know,
Saud.
I mean, Saudi Arabia
is
controlled by this family, basically. And the ordinary Saudis are not doing a hell of a lot of benefit from the riches. I
mean, and don't they resent it? They know the Americans are propping up this House of Saud. They know that.
These riches are being spent on gold-plated air conditioners. I mean, the biggest air conditioner in the world has a 7-kilometre tunnel from the from the power unit to where the cool air is used. I mean, these guys have got the money, but
have they got the sense?
No, well, look, when the temperature is 43 or 45 degrees, I guess you need an air conditioner. But you see, this is the scary thing. A place like Saudi Arabia, their population is doubled and quadrupled, and they're dependent on energy. Well, they've got the oil, so they're going to be fine financially, but environmentally, who knows?
Yeah. So we could very well have actually reached the peak already.
Well,
and there'll be a lag before we finally realise, before that the economies start sort of slowing down. And really, it becomes obvious what's actually happening.
Exactly. Well, look, it's happening already, I think, Jason. The answer is places like Zimbabwe have gone under. Nicaragua.
Well, there's political reasons, though, in Zimbabwe. I mean, Mugabe's destroying the country, isn't
Absolutely.
He? You can't put it down to people.
Well, what I'm saying is it's happening for various reasons. Not just Zimbabwe. Nicaragua, Indonesia, Philippines. Countries are finding it difficult to pay $60 a barrel for oil.
That's right. It's gone up. So the impoverished countries.
We're talking 2 years ago.
Will be the first to feel the heat.
Two years ago, the price was around $22, $28. I mean, go back to what?
Just 2 years ago. It's incredible, isn't it?
I did a presentation to Waitakere City Council a couple of years ago, and I said to these guys, look, this is coming. It's going to be like a tsunami. The time to prepare for it is now. At that time, I think oil, from memory, was about 35. About 35 or so.
Yeah, it was 35.
Heading up, you know, towards the 40, 45. This is very interesting. Yes, maybe we should. Oh, no, it's a bit hard. No, we'll put it in the too hard basket. Same with Manukau City Council. I mean, any of these people. Oh, no, no. We'll wait. We'll wait for more evidence, you know. Well, then it goes up to 71. It's dropped back again. Now, at the moment, oil has dropped about 61. So everybody says, oh, great, you know, panic over. Petrol's down from $1.56 to $1.40. So that means everything's fine. Carry on as usual, business as usual. Well, look, is there more oil now than there was a year ago or less? Well, we know the answer's less, of course. And any new oil that might come on stream is getting harder to produce. We're getting into the heavier oils, the oils that have got more sulfur. So America, having had 5% of its economy wiped out, now you'd think, well, how? This is surely a
thanks to that's thanks to Hurricane
Katrina.
Thanks to the global
warming. I mean, it's all Katrina and a little bit from Rita. Sure. So what happens? Well, the IEA says, oh, well, can we borrow a bit of your oil from Europe, or just, you know? So what's going to happen? It's going to be those with the money are going to outbid the poor countries. It's happening now. And is New Zealand a rich country or a poor country? Well, this is where it gets interesting, because this country,
we're fairly in the middle, aren't we? We're in the middle somewhere.
Look, in the last 2 months, this country spent $2 billion more than it earned. I mean, we're running at around $1 billion a month trade deficit. And how long can you keep that up? Well, economists say, well, if you've got more than 6.5% or 7%. Trade deficit on GDP, then you're a banana republic. Well, here we are at 8, headed for 10. I don't know what that makes New Zealand. It's certainly it's interesting, to say the least.
Yeah.
How is New Zealand going to pay for its oil imports? And
right.
In the meantime, we've got to come back to the government. Oh, well, it's a do-nothing approach. I mean, I've written to government ministers till I'm blue in the face, and I just don't waste my time anymore. I said, well, what have we got? We've got this issue of global warming. We've got the issue of oil depletion. So we need some policies that actually make sense. How about we stop importing SUVs and racing cars? This will save us on, you know, our money going overseas. In terms of balance of payments, it is better for the environment. Well, I mean, the government does absolutely nothing, of course. They've got no intention of doing anything. So
Not much leadership there, is there?
Sorry, what was
not
that?
Not much leadership. Yeah, not much leadership. It's shocking,
well,
really.
We call
these people our leaders?
Leading the country down, you know, down the garden path, I suppose you might say. Or leading the country off the cliff. Certainly, they're very good at that. Solving any problems? No way, guys. No way. No, they're not interested in solving any problems. We've got a government of total hypocrisy. There's no question about it. They say, well, we've got to address carbon dioxide emissions, but we're going to import SUVs and racing cars. We're going to support TVNZ in the promotion of these things. Junk food, takeaways, we're going to build coal-powered fire station. This is just denial of reality.
What are the solutions? What can the ordinary person do?
Well, the first thing any ordinary person needs to do is wake up to reality, and the way you're going to do that, of course, is to use the internet. You don't need to be a wizard to log in words like peak oil and food production. Recession 2005. I mean, a lot of this stuff has been predicted. Oh, no, it can't happen. The economists say, no, growth, you know. So it's fascinating because the people who are in control of our society are people who are either outright liars or totally disillusioned. They certainly haven't got the first clue as to how the planet operates.
They're basically incompetent.
They've got no idea how the planet operates. And as I pointed out some time ago when I was involved with Direct Democracy, and I said, look, without energy, nothing happens. That's it. I mean, we are biological machines. If you stop feeding us, we die. So that's it, guys. You know, and our food production is dependent on oil. Our food production is also dependent
on
climate.
What would you, Kevin, I want to stop you just here. Yeah. What would you like to have seen happened in the last sort of 10 years? What do you think?
Should have happened.
Yeah.
Well, look, this should have been addressed in the 1980s. We should, if the will had been there, we would all be driving very small cars. We'd have bicycle tracks all over the place. We'd have a public transport system that functions. We'd have a rail system that functions.
Light rail and rail.
Yeah, because these, it's all about using what energy you have as efficiently as possible. We've got a system which is essentially, particularly in the 90s, it was about using energy as inefficiently as possible. We had people advertising on television that you should use more electricity. Please, please, please use more, because it was all about profit. Now, at least, we've got back from that a little bit. I mean, there is some sort of wallpapering, I suppose, over the cracks, but it's still... There is some acknowledgement that we have got some slight problems, you know?
That's too little too late, really?
Too little too late. Now, it's getting to the point where there will be survivors and perishers around the world. In fact, it's already happening in some countries. What you've got to think about is there's going to be food inflation. Because if you've got a system that's dependent on resources which are vanishing rapidly, as our food production system is, I mean, all it's going to take is for demand to considerably outstrip supply and a bidding situation.
That's when inflation happens.
With oil supply, and some people thought it might happen this year, it probably won't now, because it looks like demand destruction is actually holding back prices. Or manipulation, who knows?
So tell you what, I've been very interested to see how inflation's started to go up in New Zealand.
Yes.
It was held down to about 2% and under for many, many years, and it's suddenly gone up 3.4%.
Yes. Well, you see, we've got it's all tied in. We've got the bank rates. I mean, every 3 months or so, America jacks up its interest rate another 0.25%, and then New Zealand either has a plummeting dollar or it raises its interest rates a little bit just to keep pace, you know.
Right.
If the New Zealand dollar fell substantially, we would be in deep shit. We just would not be able to pay for our oil imports.
And our whole economy will just collapse.
But it's going to collapse anyway. This is the interesting thing. Globalisation's got no future whatsoever because it's dependent on oil supply.
Completely.
Tourism's got no future whatsoever because it's dependent on oil supply. And we've got people in government telling us, well, this is what we need to promote. So talk about short-term thinking. How much money can we make this year before the system crashes?
It's absolutely ludicrous.
It is. But this is the system. Look, where you go from here. Look, personally, I'm actually getting involved in permaculture. So look, we've got to actually start using every bit of land that we've got that we can use for food production.
In a sustainable way, which doesn't use oil and fertilizers and pesticides.
Exactly. There's no money in this for big business. People making their own wine, growing their own food, where's the profit? Okay, a packet of seeds. Well, Well, you know what Monsanto thinks about that. They say, no, thank you, we'll have a Terminator gene in our GE crops, thank you very much, so you can't use the seeds. Fortunately, the world is pulling back from GE because it just doesn't work. Argentina's realised that, Britain's realised it. There's a lot of damage done in the process. Yeah. You don't hear too much from Helen Clark about it these days.
No, we
and
don't,
I mean,
actually.
She was
no, you're right. Yeah, she was.
Damn hard.
Up until a few years ago. Yeah.
Now the shit's starting to hit the fan on GE around the world. We don't hear too much about how wonderful GE is. We're still hearing about, you know, the trade deals and you know, as we said before, I think, you know, Helen Clark would do a free trade deal with anybody. I mean,
this is the devil.
This is desperation, you know.
She'd do the free trade agreement with the Nazi Germany.
Yeah, yes, absolutely.
I mean, there seems to be no standards whatsoever. No ethical judgment.
No judgment. Look, I mean. You think about energy. As I said, without energy, nothing happens. So we had Pete Thompson. I mean, he was really away with the fairies. Some people thought they were actually getting through to him on peak oil. But for whatever reason...
Who was Pete Thompson?
He was the energy minister. Now, whether he left or he was pushed...
Oh, you mean Pete Hodgson, didn't you?
Did I say Thompson?
You said Thompson. Pete Hodgson.
Pete Hodgson, sorry, yes.
Sure. No, he didn't have a clue, did he?
He was just a
talking head for the for the oil industry.
So we get rid of him. So we put a guy who's got no knowledge whatsoever of energy in as energy minister, Trevor Mallard. Well, so what does he do? Well, he just carries on with the policies of denial of reality. So, okay, well, we'll get rid of him. We'll get somebody else. I mean, it's just... Where is the cohesion? There isn't any. It's just, well, let's grab the next straw or stick this little plug in the dam that's leaking for the moment till we can find the next
one. So, Kevin, it's becoming increasingly obvious we can't rely on our so-called leaders in the government for giving us guidance in what is turning out to be a huge civilizational crisis, which is just what we're on the brink of.
Yes.
So who are the people that we should be listening to? Who are the sources of information that we should be going to?
Well, look, anybody who wants to find out about oil crash as regards to New Zealand can just log in oil crash into a computer and that will take you to oilcrash.com.
Which is a New Zealand site. Right.
Devoted to raising public awareness about the fact that it's happening and offering some solutions and a certain amount of critique of political parties and the inept politicians. Permaculture.
We should get books on permaculture, basically Bill Mollison's books.
Yes.
And who's the other guy who started up permaculture? There's another Australian man. I've forgotten his name too, but yes. He's got some books out which are really good too. I've seen them.
Trotter's another good guy in Australia. Trotter, there's a guy called Trotter. A lot of people. The knowledge is there.
Yeah.
Look, without blowing my own trumpet, I actually know a lot about this. I'm working at the gate. But people don't want to know. Oh, it's too hard. You know, denial of reality is much more convenient. And again, I forget which writer it was, but somebody said, look, when you've got an economy which is based on convenience, then you've had it. If that's the main priority for your economy is convenience food, the convenience of getting in a car and driving where you want, you know, the convenience of hopping on a plane, that's it. I mean, how long have humans lived on this planet? Depending on what you classify as a human, around 1 million years. And how long have we had shopping malls and drive-through takeaways? Well, the answer is in New Zealand, maybe 30 years.
In
America, perhaps 60. This is an abnormality. This is an aberration, a very, very temporary aberration. But people in this country and all around the world, in the developed world, think this is normal. They think this is how it should be.
Absolutely. That's how most people think.
And I wrote an article in a magazine which is called The Truth About Oil, why petrol prices will continue to rise. Now, they may not in the short term. We're going to get fluctuations up and down. But over a period of months and years, it's bound to happen. In this particular article, I'm talking about, you know, offerings of racing cars for street use. You know, 250 kilowatts of energy. Like, this is like a Roman galley with 1,000 slaves, you know, each of them working away at their oars at 250 watts, which is quite an output for a human being. People think this is normal. They think it's normal to chew through energy like there's no tomorrow. They think they have a right to do this, an expectation. Well, is it surprising when this is exactly what the media present? The media, see, we've got all these, society devoted to worshipping the motor car. So, it's scary.
Now, Kevin, I wanted to ask you about, a lot of people argue that somehow, I think there's this kind of belief, there's such, the power of technology has such a hold over people, they believe that somehow the superpowers, I rang up Talkback Radio once and talked to this Talkback host about peak oil, and he said, well, the superpowers will just bring out some amazing new invention that will save everyone.
Oh, yes.
Now, some of these inventions people mentioned to me, I've had arguments with people about the hydrogen fuel cells, for example. Can you tell us a little bit why hydrogen fuel cell technology is not going to save us?
Well, the best one, of course, is the car that runs on water, and there's a guy that, you know, lived up in Tiki Tiki or whatever, and, you know, and he was shut down by a big oil because they couldn't have this guy, you know, running cars on water. And I said, oh, yeah, well, if you believe that, you know.
Well,
you might as well plant $10 notes in the ground and hope that they're going to grow into money trees, because...
I've heard some stories about those cars that run on oil, and I've seen a car that ran, Blue Kennedy, who's a New Zealand inventor, he did invent a car that ran on water. It didn't go very fast,
but he did
have a car that ran on water.
Yeah, I mean, this is just denial of the rules of physics and chemistry, because water doesn't contain any free energy. It's the product of combustion. So when you burn oil, or petrol, or whatever, or coal, you know, you're ending up with carbon and carbon dioxide. Sorry, not in the case with coal, there's not a hell of a lot of hydrogen in coal, but particularly in the case of methane or petrol, you burn it, you get the energy out, and you get the product water.
Yeah, okay.
I mean, water's at the bottom of this energy.
We're talking about internal combustion engines, okay? Yeah. Now, there are alternative
steam
technologies.
Engines. Yeah, they run on water.
Yeah. But there's other things too.
Oh, sorry, you've got to put a lot of coal or wood in there to heat the water.
Anyway, that's a separate argument. Nikola Tesla, his technology, but I want to go back to the hydrogen fuel cells.
Yeah, well, okay. When people talk about water, they're talking usually about splitting water to make hydrogen, and they forget that bit, and they say, I've got a car that runs on water, but it actually runs on hydrogen.
Okay, well, obviously you don't think water's an option.
Well, that is just ridiculous. I mean,
but what about hydrogen fuel cells? That's the one that the main one that people bring up.
Of course, because you see, you've got people like the AA say, oh, yeah, look, the hydrogen economy's on its way. We'll all be driving around in hydrogen cars in a few years.
The US Army is going into hydrogen fuel cells, apparently, in big time.
Yes.
So they obviously see it as some kind of option. Now, why do you think it's not a realistic option?
Look, it's not an option at all. This is just another rort operated by people who want to produce cars or hydrogen fuel cells. Now, to make hydrogen... Well, firstly, the hydrogen doesn't occur anywhere naturally. There's tiny amounts of it in the upper atmosphere, but there are no sources of hydrogen. You've got to make it. Now, there are only two ways, really, to make it. One is from natural gas, which we're running out of.
Yeah.
So, why do that? What's the point? There is no point. You might as well use the natural gas as it is. Going back to the big thing, I mean, it would have been cheaper and more efficient to have given every motorist a CNG conversion kit back in, you know, 1980 than to build this Motunui thing and do a chemical conversion and end up with a liquid fuel produced at around a 50 or so percent efficiency. But it was convenient. Right.
So they converted gas into petrol, basically, with about losing about 50%
of
that gas.
Of the energy.
That was the thing, big.
This all comes back to the energy in the fuel.
Right.
All right. Stored energy, if you like to think of it that way. I mean, it's all to do with bond energy, and that's getting a little bit too difficult for non-chemists to deal with. But, you know, when atoms combine, energy's released, and it normally takes energy to pull them apart. So if you want to pull apart a water molecule, you've got to put energy into it. And now you've got the hydrogen, and okay, if you let these atoms go back together again, then you get the energy back. But you get less back than what you put in. Oh dear. Depending on the efficiency of the process, you might get back, if you're lucky, 70% of the energy that you put into it. So that's not a very good way of, coming back to what I said before, of using energy efficiently. Now the problem with hydrogen, and it's damn difficult stuff to store, it's the lightest element. The molecules are incredibly small and virtually nothing will hold the stuff. You've got to have super valves to contain hydrogen. It's impossible to compress. It won't liquefy at normal temperature. You've got to drop the temperature really, effectively you've got to take it down to about minus 200, minus 250 degrees Celsius. Then you can pressurize it, you can liquefy it. But what does that take? Energy. So you're expending all this energy.
Yeah.
In order to squash hydrogen into a container. But the energy density is still very low. So you then got to have this massive, either highly insulated container.
Okay, Kevin, so nuclear power does not seem to be a very good option for a lot of reasons. I mean, it's dangerous and it could have its own peak. Uranium could run out. It also puts CO2 into the atmosphere. It's expensive and it's reliant on only big business controlling it. What about biofuels? A lot of people talk about biofuels, like fuels being grown with corn. I mean, in Brazil they use alcohol. Are those an option?
Well, yeah, look, this is very interesting because the media love these sorts of stories about, you know, some car that's driving around Britain or Australia or whatever, you know, using recycled chip oil. Cooking fat. Oh, this is wonderful. This is the future, you know.
We've all got hope. We can all live in hope again.
Yes, you know, don't worry, people. Oh, well, we've got all these problems. And, yeah, well, we're going to recycle all these natural products. And you say, yes, but what sort of quantity? I actually had some email correspondence with a crowd in Scotland that were, you know, promoting all this. And this had gone through BBC World. And I said, yeah, well, what sort of quantity have we got here? Well, yeah, they're talking like 5,000 barrels a year. Excuse me. I mean, it's just a joke. Because the quantity of oil that's used, you know, by people on this planet, we're talking about 82 to 84 million barrels a day. Now, I'm quoting you a figure, a range there, because nobody's really sure at the moment. There's some speculation that of an extraction decline or a use decline. Let's say 84. I mean, we've got the IEA saying, oh, yeah, this is going to grow, blah, 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 and by 2025 we'll be using 120 million barrels a year. So really, you know, this is interesting because that's not what the oil geologists are saying. You know, so economists are better at finding oil than oil geologists. But, I mean, that aside, with 84 million barrels, we're talking 30 billion barrels of oil, and a barrel is 160 litres. Right? And, that, you know, we've got these people talking about where, you know, we get 20,000 litres of oil a year or something.
Yeah.
Excuse me, you know. Now, that's one aspect. Now, number two, if you're looking at things like rapeseed oil, which sounds great, you know, or canola oil or whatever, soybean, well, how do you get this? Well, unfortunately, this is where starts to look very silly, because quite often this has been produced by a mechanized industrial system. You know, a tractor gone out there and sown the seed, and it's been harvested mechanically, and it's been brought back, and then the electricity's been used to run some crushing system, milling or boiling it up or whatever, and extraction systems and pumps and filters.
Which all takes oil?
And when a proper analysis is done of the energy returned on the energy investment, it's very easy to get into negative. In other words, you expend more energy making this damn stuff than you get back at the end of it. Now, I mean, I've been a little bit tongue-in-cheek on this whole issue, and I've written articles, and I said, well, this is fine. If you can get yourself an army of Chinese peasants and just get them to work the fields for you, no mechanization, yeah, they can grow this stuff and collect it by hand, and you can have a few of these peasants operating these machines by by hand, yeah, you can end up with probably a positive energy profit ratio. Make sure you don't pay them anything, just give them enough food to survive on. But as soon as you start using this product that you're making in order to grow it, the numbers don't stack up at all well. And it just depends on exactly how it's done, whether you're going to have a positive or negative energy profit return here. So it ain't all glory days at all. Now the other aspect is, we're using these huge amounts of oil, so if we're going to produce vast quantities of biodiesel or ethanol or any other of these products, which bit of our agricultural system are we going to sacrifice in order to produce this stuff? Because we've not exactly got, billions of hectares of land lying around waiting to be used. Places like China, they're actually got encroachment of deserts, they've got water depletion problems. Australia's the same. They're using water faster than it's falling out of the sky.
They've got salination
problems
too, haven't they? Australia, big time.
India, a lot of countries are actually using ancient water. They're lowering their water tables.
Which is causing the earth to become more salty and then things can't grow there.
Yeah, so nothing grows in the end. I mean, you hear some... it's speculative, but you hear reports about, Victoria maybe in 50 years' time, half of the current agricultural land will be unusable. And we've got people talking about growing crops to run cars. And I think, well, just a minute, I think we might be needing that land to grow food. Particularly...
They're off the planet, aren't they? They're off the planet.
Absolutely off the planet. Total denial of reality. I mean, anybody that makes these sorts of comments actually either doesn't know any of the facts or totally ignores them. They know the facts and it just doesn't fit the argument. I mean, there's a lot of this. It's a bit like the creationists, Well, the Earth was created 6,000 years ago. Therefore, we must find all the evidence that fits this argument, right? So and any evidence that doesn't fit our argument, we will just totally ignore. So it's the same with biology.
Well, that's the Christian creationist. I mean, I'm a creationist,
I'm talking about this particular this particular
crowd. I know what
crowd.
You mean. Yeah, who are arguing against any scientific idea of evolution.
So, they look at the Grand Canyon and say, "Well, isn't it? Oh, these rocks. Oh, yeah, this is like a kilometre deep." This was produced by the flood, in 6 days.
Right.
And people say, well, just a minute, this is granite here. You're saying that this was eroded over a period of 6 days. Oh, well, God works in wonderful ways. Biodiesel. God works in wonderful ways. It's feeding the fishes.
Just another...
Feeding the 20,000 with a handful of fish.
Just another economist's wet dream, basically.
Absolutely. This is not popular to say this.
Yeah. But geophysics,
reality.
Geology beats economics every time.
Absolutely. In this case, of course, it's chemistry.
Chemistry, which is part of geology in a way.
Yes, it is. I mean, the physical sciences, that's what we're talking here.
Yeah. Earth science.
Economics, as somebody said to me many years ago, isn't a subject. It's not actually a topic. You cannot teach economics because there's not one known economics principle that you can be sure will rely on.